Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know the drill. We're recording on Wednesday morning. A couple things before we introduce our first guest. One, I posted something on Facebook this morning because I've been listening to the discussion of Donald Trump and the jury trial. And of course, in some ways, I'm laughing because Donald Trump has never had to sit in a hard wooden chair for more than an hour in his entire life. So now he's going to have to sit in a hard, uncomfortable wooden chair for weeks on end. And I can't, if anything breaks him, that will break him. It's not going to be the anxiety of all the trials. It's not going to be, you know, campaigning. It's not going to be from eating all the McDonald's or, you know, Kentucky Fried or whatever he's doing. It's going to be from sitting there because it's in a confined space where he is not in control. And it's terribly uncomfortable. Terribly uncomfortable. And that for him will be a form of water torture. But as I was thinking about this, I wanted to mention something. I wrote, I have served on two juries, an amazing experience of democracy in action. I learned from my fellow jurors who came from every walk of life. And in one case, it was an NRA member who came with his knowledge of guns that turned out to be pivotal in our ultimate verdict. It was the most amazing experience. I, honest to God, if I understand democracy or think about it as being something that I value and I want to see it not only continue but be repaired, it was my experience in the Constitutional Convention back in 1984, and it's been my experience on juries. You know, and this is from someone who's done politics their whole life, and yet these were the two moments that I think I really understood what it was I was defending. And then last but not least, what I want to do is continue what I have been describing as a discussion of Project 2025, the latest plot against America. We are up to installment number 6. This comprehensive 900-page playbook was produced under the auspices of the Heritage Foundation and supported by over 100 partner organizations. It was officially entitled Mandate for Leadership, the Conservative Promise. Project 2025 lays out specifics for hundreds of policy objectives affecting every area of public life, from women and the LGBTQ populations to environmental regulations to the concentration of power in the executive branch to promote an authoritarian regime. We are up to the fourth of 10 things you need to know about Project 2025. The area I'm focusing on today is called public health. The recommendations concerning health are dispersed among the introduction and various chapters. Together, they argue for an abandonment of the government's role in promoting public health for American children and adults. The author of the foreword is Heritage President Kevin Roberts, and the chapter on the Department of Health and Human Services is Roger Severino, a former Trump appointee who previously served as the director of the DeVos Center at the Heritage Foundation. His wife, CNP member Carrie Severino, who clerked for Clarence Thomas, currently heads the Judicial Crisis Network, which coordinates efforts with Leonard Leo on federal court appointments. Roberts' foreword launches a full-bore assault on LGBTQ and reproductive rights in an Orwellian exercise seeking to erase the very vocabulary of social progress from the national discourse. The next conservative president must make the institutions of American civil society hard targets for woke culture warriors. This starts with deleting the terms sexual orientation and gender identity, diversity, equity, and inclusion, gender equality, gender awareness, gender sensitive, abortion, reproductive health, with deleting the term sexual orientation and completely, and any other term used to deprive Americans of their First Amendment rights out of every federal rule, agency, regulation, contract, grant, right, and of course, piece of legislation that exists. And here's how Anne translates that section on public health. Translation, forget the goal of health if it involves female organs. That's really what she saw as the takeaway from that section in Project 2025. I may not recommend that you read all 900 pages. I absolutely recommend that you read Anne's fabulous piece, again, Project 2025, the latest plot against America. You can find it at the Washington Spectator. So as you know, one of my favorite places to go is the American Prospect. I go to it all the time because I like to sort of see what's David Day in writing, what's Harold Meyerson writing, because those are our favorites. We have them on the air with us all the time. But they also bring in interesting writers to add more content to their material. And immediately I saw a piece that triggered lots of reaction in me, in part because we cover Texas, in part because we cover Florida, Remember what happened as a result of the hurricanes, rising sea levels, what happened with the fires in Canada that not only happened in Canada, but we smelled the smoke and could see the smoke in New Hampshire. I just want to make people to realize that the climate crisis is impacting us in so many ways. But the title of the piece at the Prospect was, Democrats must start distinguishing themselves on insurance policy. Amid a crisis for homeowners, Democrats have done little, while Republicans pursue an agenda of bailouts and deregulation. And as I read that headline, I said, oh, you must be around when we talked to Andres Croy about Florida, because that's exactly Ron DeSantis' agenda. It is about bailouts and deregulation. So joining us right now are the author of this wonderful article. Plus, there was a report that also came out that really sort of looks at this whole story of insurance and why we need to pay attention. Jordan, is it, now pronounce your last name, Jordan. I didn't ask you to. Is it Hedler?
Hetler, yes.
Hetler is a freelance writer and nonprofit professional. His pieces on climate change, politics, and the Fed have appeared in Grist, The Nation, The Hill, and Huffington Post. Thank you so much for doing this, Jordan.
Thank you for having me.
And Kenny Stancil is a senior researcher at the Revolving Door Project. We actually have interviewed a number of people from the Revolving Door Project, and I want to thank Kenny for joining us as well. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. Let's talk about this story of homeowner insurance, because I think when I say the word insurance, let's be honest, Kenny, and you know this as well as Jordan, that immediately what do people think about? They think about health insurance, okay? Because that's the thing we talk about. You know, we talk about the Affordable Care Act, well, you know, Donald Trump will overturn it. We talk about people who want single payer. And the thing that most people are intimate with is health insurance because it affects all of us, okay? It's universal. Homeowner insurance, however, is a bit more of a privileged conversation. And that is, it assumes that you own a piece of property, okay? And it's the wealthy that own property, and it's the middle class that own property. And maybe if you're poor, you might have inherited your property, okay? So that's, it sort of shrinks the pool slightly. But what is so valuable about the conversation about homeowner insurance is that for most middle class families, frankly, for most families in America, your home is your most vital asset. If you have wealth, it is your home. You don't have a lot in the stock market. You don't have a lot in your 10K, but it's your home that you really sort of see both as a place where you have refuge. You know, it provides you with shelter, but it also is your most valuable asset. So as people look at the challenges of home ownership, when they're looking at affordability, Jordan, a lot of people are completely out of the loop on affordability. I mean, they see a house on the market and they literally within 15 minutes might even sort of call their realtor and they find out that there's already been overbid by 70,000. So they're not able to buy a home. And then they look at the carrying costs of having a home. So it's not just what they pay for the home and the mortgage, but you know this, Kenny, it's the idea that they have to pay the mortgage, they have to pay the property taxes, because if they have a mortgage, absolutely, they're going to have to pay for their homeowner's insurance. And then, of course, they have to heat their house, they have to electrify their house, and then they have to maintain their house. And the numbers are just astronomical. But the story that you and Jordan are telling in this article, as well as in your report, is about something that I think people are just coming to Jesus on, which is the rising cost of home insurance. So since I'm going to start with the Revolving Door Project, which is really, I think, where this sort of study originated, Kenny, talk to us a little bit about what's happening with homeowner insurance. And your article was really kind of a scolding to the Democratic Party, which is that your role is not just to push back on Republicans who appear to be offering something in a way of a solution, but is a non-solution because it benefits the industry and not the homeowner. But the Democrats have to come up with something, which is, what's your response? What is your positive response? You know, the Affordable Care Act was your sort of quasi-positive response to the health insurance crisis. It didn't even get close, but it's something. Let's talk about what's going on now in the home insurance market first, set that table, and then start offering me some ideas on what the hell to do. So, Kenny, let's start by talking about this sort of the tragic story of what's happening in the home insurance industry.
Absolutely. Well, this issue is becoming impossible to ignore. And just one thing that I would add to your introduction, even though we focus on homeowners insurance in the piece and the prospect, basically, the insurance crisis also affects multifamily housing and apartment buildings, and that's going to have a lot of effects on renters as well. So this really does affect everyone. As I mentioned, it's becoming impossible to ignore because in the past year or so, there's constant reports about insurers basically withdrawing from at-risk communities The irony, of course, is that these same insurance companies that are abandoning vulnerable areas are still underwriting fossil fuel production, which guarantees, you know, worse and worse extreme weather disasters. So that's one really obvious area where Democratic lawmakers could make a difference, I think, is really advocating for divestment from fossil fuel companies, not allowing insurers to continue profiting from fossil fuel investment, and then also leaving residents high and dry. And so just to take like a step back, I think it's important to understand, and this might come as a surprise to a lot of people, that most of the insurance industry is regulated at the state level. And that's thanks to this obscure 1945 law called the McCarran-Ferguson Act. So even though most oversight happens at the state level, not all of it does. So there is still some room for, you know, federal actors to do something. However, what makes it even worse is that the state regulators who could be doing more, they're kind of asleep at the wheel, and they defer to this private organization called the National Association for Insurance Commissioners. And NAIC, it basically exists to perpetuate this low baseline of regulations because they are really influential in setting state insurance policies. And so they create, you know, the lowest possible baseline that insurance commissioners, many of them, kind of just defer to. They also really oppose federal intervention, and they're defensive of this state-based system. The NAIC is a big obstacle here, which is what the report focuses on. But then going back to your question about, you know, what could Democrats do differently? They're kind of missing in action right now because Republicans, as you mentioned, have proposed a false solution, bailouts and deregulation. I think people are yearning for, and Democrats could really benefit politically if they proposed an affirmative real solution. And so some things that they could do are like really to make sure that they're increasing consumer protections and greater investment in climate resilient property upgrades, even just more funding for state insurance offices, which are really under-resourced, could help. And then finally, implementing recommendations that the Treasury Department's Federal Insurance Office proposed last year. So using better tools to measure and address climate-related financial risks. For instance, just to give you one example, right now, only 20% of, well, let me take one step back. There's a newish climate risk disclosure survey that the NIAC is now conducting after years of efforts by consumer advocates to make them do this. And still only 20% of the disclosures even mention something called scenario analysis, you know, kind of trying to figure out what's going to happen if under scenario A, B, C, and D. Only a handful of companies even considered scenarios where global temperatures rise more than 2 degrees Celsius. And just for context, the world's currently barreling toward roughly 3 degrees Celsius of warming. So it's just like, you know, their heads are buried in the sand. And yeah, so I think this is an area that's ripe for intervention and ripe for Democrats to call out Republicans for what is really a pro-industry agenda of just whatever consumer protections exist, trying to eliminate those, deregulate the industry further, and allow the insurance industry to do what it wants, which is socialize losses and maximize profits.
All right, so Jordan, I love what you're telling me, Kenny, but I'm going to be incredibly practical here. And having been a former politician, I refer to myself as a politician in recovery. I understand the connection to the climate crisis, and I understand the connection of the fact that they're still underwriting coal, oil, and gas companies, okay? And they're the ones that are exacerbating the problem with the climate. The problem is that doesn't fix the problem for the person who can't afford their home insurance. And what we're talking about is a long-term solution. And we've lost our sense of generational ethics. We don't plan for a decade from now or 100 years from now. We want immediacy. That doesn't mean that you don't address the fossil fuel issue, which we have to. We absolutely have to. But at the same time, when you understand what the Democrats need to do, they need to also appeal to the moment. Because the moment is, if my homeowner insurance is now larger than my mortgage, and something happens to my house, and I found out that they deregulated, and I can't get a response from the insurance industry, or they're going to lowball their returns, I need to know that my government is trying to do something to at least create some level of fairness, if nothing else, and will cover my ass. I'll be honest with you. So I guess that's part of the problem, Jordan. And I also think that one of the things that I've been thinking about as I'm listening to Kenny is that we have this idea that, you know, the problem is invisible, but you were telling me about Minnesota. And I want people to hear this story from Minnesota, because when I think of, you know, the rising cost of homeowner insurance, I'm thinking of the fires in Florida. I mean, the fires in California. I'm thinking of the hurricanes in Texas. I'm thinking of the rising sea level rises in Florida plus the hurricanes. But would never in a million years would even Minnesota like even pop into my head. But let my audience know what you told me off air, because I think they have to understand that the consequences of this is enormous, and it's happening in places everywhere. But people just sort of almost need to sort of come together collectively and say, me too, me too, me too. Because in a lot of ways, what the industry hopes is nobody sort of tells their neighbor. And then all of a sudden, once we all realize what is happening, we will want a government and policy response.
Well, that's absolutely right. A lot of the media attention on this issue has focused on coastal states.
Yes.
But there was a hearing in the Minnesota House Commerce Committee in February where experts testified that Minnesota actually ranks second amongst extreme weather damages. And we're seeing that actually all throughout the Midwest. A lot of hail and windstorms are actually causing more damage and insurance payouts than some of the, you know, things that make the news in Florida and California. Some of the consumer hazards that have been worst have been observed in Iowa, Nebraska. And notably, from a political angle, a lot of this is happening in swing states. North Carolina has an important insurance commissioner election this year. The Midwest, you know, the upper Midwest, there's all sorts of consumer hazards being observed. And Arizona has 76% of Arizonans live in a county that's estimated to rank in the top 15 for expected annual losses from wildfire damage over the near future. So this is an issue that is happening everywhere, not just along the coasts. It's a key way that climate change is being understood as a pocketbook issue. So I think it's really important that Democrats understand this issue and get a handle on it, both from a political and policy standpoint, so that we can understand how to navigate the climate crisis for many years to come. And I do think that there are solutions available right now that Democrats can seize on. President Biden put forward multiple infrastructure packages that have billions of dollars in spending that is meant to help communities, homeowners, and businesses upgrade their properties to make them more climate resilient. That can be harmonized with policy at the state level. California, for instance, has a new rule that requires that insurers offer discounts to homeowners that pursue those sorts of property upgrades. Mm-hmm. And it's not just a blue state like California. Alabama, Louisiana, North Carolina, they all have roof fortification programs that are not that widely understood, and people need to be made aware of them and take advantage of them. And there's also a number of regulatory changes that the Biden administration has put forward that state lawmakers and state policymakers, whom the report that the Biden administration issued were the intended audience, are largely unaware of. Sure. And that's the final thing that I want to say, which is that, you know, I understand your point that you're a pragmatist, you're a recovering politician. You've been in a state house and you know how powerful corporate interests tend to be in these state houses that don't get the same level of scrutiny or attention that Congress does. Right now, there's an available coalition of housing, consumer, racial justice, and even antitrust organizations, small business associations that can come together. And of course, climate and environmental organizations as well, that can be made to assemble and get a common policy, get smart on insurance policy, and begin to be in touch with their state legislators and emphasizing the importance of this, because right now the insurance lobby is the only voice at the table.
Exactly.
In Sacramento, in Tallahassee, in Carson City, in St. Paul. That can and should change.
So, Kenny, I love it, though, that what's been put together is the revolving door project, because when you look at so many of the insurance commissioners around the country, I suspect they come from a revolving door. I suspect that where they come from is the insurance industry. So it's not uncommon. And again, what I think is so important is not only do we need Democrats to become well-versed in these issues, the challenges of these issues, but they actually are given opportunities on a regular basis to talk about it, whether it's an election of an insurance commissioner, whether it's an appointment of an insurance commissioner, whether it's writing the budget for the insurance department. It is like so important. And I'm gonna sort of grieve publicly. I remember when my Democratic governor, who's now a U.S. senator, chose the long-time 25-year-old banking lobbyist and head of the New Hampshire Bankers Association to become the commissioner of banking. And I'm like, what the hell? I mean, and this was the Democrat that did it. So I just want people to know, you know, don't assume that Republicans make bad choices. Democrats make bad choices too. But that's another reason why we need to become incredibly well-versed. And as I mentioned to both Jordan and Kenny, is that we have Anders Croy on from Florida Watch all the time. And he begins almost every 2 weeks with the crisis in homeowner insurance. Every 2 weeks. That's almost the first words out of his mouth. And his frustration with how DeSantis and the Republican legislature has basically sold out to the insurance industry. It has not helped consumers. It has not changed anything. Policies really haven't really protected people in Florida. What has happened is they've used it as a cudgel, but they haven't done anything to actually help the people, but they've definitely helped the industry. And I think that that's part of the problem is a level of collective, not ignorance per se, but there's just a lack of sophistication that, you know, this is not a solution, but there are other things that you can do. And I guess I need to ask this question, because I did see that you mentioned at the very beginning, and I'll go with you, Kenny, was that the feds don't actually have a significant impact on this question of homeowner insurance. And you mentioned that it was largely preempted by the McCarran-Ferguson Act. What the hell did that do? That was 1945. We're talking 2024. Like, why is that bill still around, and why hasn't someone amended it, I guess, Kenny? So I don't know what it does, but I guess I need to start with what the hell is this and what does it do?
Yeah, well, this is it's obscure and it's old, but it could precipitate like the next financial.
So is the Comstock Act. So just to remind you, we're doing a lot of old things again. Keep going.
Well, it's ripe for change. That would require congressional action. But basically, it exempted most of the insurance industry from federal regulation. And so, you know, Jordan can maybe add more backstory there. But I think that to hit on another point you made, there is a disturbing percentage of state insurance commissioners come from the insurance industry. So the revolving door is really rampant there. Yeah, I think, Jordan, do you want to say more about McCarran-Ferguson?
Yeah, so McCarran-Ferguson was a 1945 congressional act that actually was first and foremost an antitrust act, and it clarified a Supreme Court decision that insurers complained would require them to proprietary information. And it's been the law of the land. It's led to this state-based regulatory system ever since 1945. And importantly, it not only federal regulation of insurance, it also preempts federal antitrust enforcement against insurance companies, which is why some states have affirmed that antitrust scrutiny of insurers is part of their state code. And I think more states should take up reforms like that. There have been numerous attempts to establish a federal regulatory system after the 2008 crisis. There were proposals to create a federal charter for insurance companies, but those proposals were all defeated against intense lobbying by the insurance industry. And so that's why we still have this state-based system. And the only federal overview of insurers is through designation of systemically important financial institutions, of which there are none that are not banks anymore following deregulation under the Trump administration.
All right. Well, thank you, gentlemen, for this sobering conversation. Please do me a favor. Share this article with your state reps. All right. That's all I'm going to say. If nothing else, just share the article with the state reps. And anyone in Florida, make sure you read the report. All right. Here we go. Democrats must start distinguishing themselves on insurance policy. Amid a crisis for homeowners, Democrats have done little. While Republicans pursue an agenda of bailouts and deregulation, it's a fabulous article at the American Prospect, written by Joe Headletter and Kenny Stancil. Thank you so much for doing this, gentlemen. I have a funny feeling we'll call you again. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Our producers, Dave Scott and Fred Portnoy. We will be right back.
This is Lincoln Mitchell with today's Mitchell Minute. On the first day of his trial here in Manhattan, Donald Trump requested that the judge give him a day off in May for his son's high school graduation. The judge said he would consider it. This led Donald Trump to go on a fit on Truth Social, and for all of his MAGA followers, say, oh my goodness, the judge won't let Trump go to his own son's high school graduation. This is all part of some huge Department of Justice plot against Trump, even though this is not being brought by the Department of Justice or by the Biden administration in any way. Now, I don't care if Donald Trump goes to his son's graduation, and I suspect on some level he doesn't either. If he does get that day off, he'll probably spend most of it on social media, watching television, giving speeches, and do a drive-by for his son's graduation. But it was hard not to hear that, not to watch that, and think of all of the Americans who are behind bars because of the excesses, the so many excesses of the carceral state, who miss all of those milestones for their children and their families. And many, many, if not most of them, have not committed crimes anything near as serious as what Donald Trump has done in Manhattan and at the national level. The Mitchell Minute is a daily minute or so of political analysis from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear more of my opinion and analysis, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel at Mitchell Minute or subscribe to my Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity, when you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells, when you see approaching the future this foretells, when they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away, when you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot, perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is part two of the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, and producers Dave Scott and Fred Portnoy. You know the drill. We're recording on Wednesday morning. Well, once a month, we go to Iowa to grab Laura Bellin. She is the publisher, editor, and primary reporter for the Bleeding Heartland, a community website focused on Iowa politics. She's also the statehouse reporter for KHOI Radio in Ames and co-host of the station's Capital Week program, as well as a member of the Iowa Writers Collaborative. I have to tell you, Laura, you eat, sleep, and drink Iowa politics. And it is so amazing. You are so comprehensive and so knowledgeable. But what I love about you is you're so damn curious. I mean, it's like you go to every little rat hole to say, why? I need to know more. I need to know more. Every state needs about 20 Lauras. I'm just telling you right now because we would all benefit. But thank you for joining us once a month. I reached out to you because my good friend, who used to be known as Dr. Politics at Iowa State, sent me this two-line note. The note was, school safety bill, and I have a few other ideas for Iowa lawmakers, have sent a bill to Governor Kim Reynolds that would allow teachers and other school employees to obtain permits to carry guns on school grounds and grant them qualified immunity for using reasonable force. And I was just thinking about, you know, parents are so concerned about school safety. And in part because we imagine the shooter. And I was just talking about whether, you know, kids should be able to keep cell phones on them when they're in class. Because if there's a biggest complaint from school teachers, it's that the disturbance of a cell phone is really made teaching very hard. So I said, well, you know, maybe you could sort of collect the cell phones at the beginning of class, and at the end of the class, you hand the cell phones back. That was one of my suggestions. But then a mother said to me, do you know why I want my kid to have a cell phone? Because in case there is a school shooting, I want to know that they have their cell phone on them so they can reach out to me, so they can reach out to the cops, so I know that they're safe. Imagine that goes into your head when you're thinking about school cell phones, and then you write the story about carrying guns on school grounds, and I'm like, oh my God, the cocktail of weapons and parents and fear and cell phones, and it's just, it's how do you teach anymore? It's becoming a toxic environment.
It really is. And the drills that the students do starting at a very young age, the active shooter drills, it's very upsetting to see this happen. And this is something, getting more guns in schools has been part of the Republican agenda for a long time. In Iowa this year, I think this bill was partly fueled because we had a horrific school shooting in January, the first week of January, right before the legislature came back to start its work. And one thing that Democrats pointed out during the debate on this so-called, you know, quote, school safety, unquote, bill, is that we know that something like 90% of school shooters are current or former students at the school that they're targeting. And so there we could be looking at all kinds of other things. We could be looking at better mental health services for troubled people. We could be looking at red flag laws or even ways to make it more difficult to enter schools without authorization. But this kind of approach, you know, that the good guy with a gun is going to stop a bad guy with a gun. I mean, this is like the zombie myth that will never die for Republicans.
Yeah, exactly. It just, I mean, there was a time where you didn't allow any kind of guns on school property, period. And now we want to be awash in guns, as if that's going to be the solution to what's going on with us.
And I think that you mentioned it briefly, but I just want to highlight the most important part of this new Iowa bill is the qualified immunity provision, because yes, it was already legal for school districts to authorize staff to be armed. But what we saw happen here is that a couple of school districts in Northwest Iowa, the most conservative part of the state, they adopted these policies allowing staff to be armed, and their insurance carriers immediately said, we're not renewing your policy. If you don't rescind, we won't cover you if you don't rescind this guns in school policy. So this, the reason why they added this qualified immunity, this says that if somebody is using a firearm at school, that they will be immune from criminal prosecution as well as civil liability from mishaps that happen. So that means if an innocent bystander or a fellow staff member is injured or killed, there is no recourse. They won't be able to sue the school district. They won't be able to sue the staff member who was armed. So the hope, at least the Republican hope, is that this will inspire more school districts to authorize this and that their insurance companies won't drop coverage.
I don't think it was Iowa, but I was reading a story about how someone did bring their gun to school because they were authorized to do it, but then they left their gun in the men's room.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there are lots of stories like that.
I'm thinking, well, wait, does qualified immunity go to that? Leaving your gun hanging around or dropping your gun from your, like, your holster in your classroom? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out, is it the use of the gun or the misuse of a gun in the sense that you've been...
I think that's a very valid question, because this came up also during the legislative debate. Yeah. People were just rattling off, and it wasn't just one incident that has happened a number of times. And so the qualified immunity, the way it's written, at least the way I read it, it says that if in a reasonable use of the firearms at school. So I think just carelessly leaving it in the bathroom, I'm not sure carelessly leaving it on the desk or accidentally discharging the weapon in class. I mean, I don't know that those types of situations would be covered. I guess we're going to find out. I mean, I think that would be of great interest to the insurance companies who cover Iowa school districts.
Well, I don't know. Are you allowed to carry guns in the Iowa legislature? Are they allowed to pack heat?
Yeah, we are too.
And I remember.
I don't think they can bring in the long guns. And there are metal detectors, but a number of state legislators have said that they concealed carry at the state capitol.
No. We have concealed carry at the state. I mean, trust me. And I remember that during a abortion hearing, one of the Republicans dropped his gun during the hearing. Mm. Now think about what the hearing was. It was about abortion. What was he carrying? He was carrying a weapon. What did he drop? What was the message there? Was that accident or design? I'm just thinking about it. Anyway, all right, we'll move on from guns. We're going to move on to the next topic of concern, which is abortion. You mentioned that the Iowa Supreme Court was hearing oral arguments this week or last week on the new big abortion case. The state wants the justices to lift the injunction on the near total ban Republicans enacted last July, and that you are in the process right now of publishing a huge deep dive on this. And has a decision been rendered yet? It has not. And you suggested that whatever decision it'll be 4-3, but you don't indicate which way they will go, which means there must be a jump ball on your Iowa Supreme Court. So I would love to know who that jump ball is. Anyway, let's talk about abortion in Iowa.
So I want to set the stage. First of all, right now, abortion is legal up to 20 weeks in Iowa. We adopted a 20-week abortion ban in 2017 that's still in place. The law that they adopted last year would be almost a total abortion ban. It would eliminate an estimated 98 or 99% of abortions, but it has been enjoined. And this isn't a final appeal on the merits of the case. This is what's called interlocutory appeal. So the state is asking the Iowa Supreme Court to lift this injunction and allow the state to enforce this abortion ban. Now, what's interesting is that we have a fully Republican-appointed Iowa Supreme Court. Five of the seven justices were appointed by our current governor, Kim Reynolds, and the other two were appointed by her predecessor, Terry Branstad. So you would think that this would be a slam dunk that they would uphold the abortion ban. However, we have had a series, as it happens, this is the sixth major abortion case to reach the Iowa Supreme Court in the last decade. So we have a pretty good idea of where most of the justices stand on this issue. And so the reason why they passed a new abortion ban was last year, the court deadlocked 3-3 on whether to allow the state to enforce the 2018 version of the misnamed, what they call the heartbeat bill. And one justice, Dana Oxley, recused from that case.
Okay.
He is not recusing from the current case. So that's why I said it's very likely to be a 4-3 decision. And nothing I heard during the oral argument suggested to me that any of the six who participated in last year's opinion have changed their mind. So three of the justices seem to me to be inclined to support some kind of a balancing test, whether you want to call it undue burden or some kind of a legal test that weighs the pregnant person's bodily autonomy and right to control their own future against the state's interest in preventing abortions, versus three justices we know for sure because of opinions they either wrote or signed on to last year. They would apply the rational basis standard, which, as we've seen in Dobbs and other state level decisions, basically a rational basis standard allows the state to do almost anything up to almost a total ban of abortion.
So it's really interesting that you talk about the fact that these are all seven justices were appointed by Republicans. So this is technically on paper a Republican Supreme Court. Do you know that that's also true about Arizona? That Arizona, all the Arizona justices are also, but what's fascinating is that it was a split decision, 5-2 or something like that. But two of the justices that were supporting this 1864 law are up for re-election this year. Mm-hmm. So this is an opportunity to use this as a way to sort of bring voters in and make them understand that, you know, who you choose as your justice is incredibly important. But again,
we don't have judicial elections in Iowa anymore, just to be clear. So that's
right. Right.
So that's
but the idea that on paper, they were all appointed by Republicans. On paper, all the justices in Arizona are Republican. So I just want people to know. But what it also speaks to is something interesting. It speaks to what the Republican Party kind of used to be and what the Republican Party is today. And when they make their appointments and they make their decisions or they enact or support laws, it feels like they're on a different planet. You know, and so just because someone happened to have been appointed by a former Republican governor doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get the sort of MAGA response that you're seeing with people like Governor Reynolds, for example, might want to appoint. So I just it just sort of adds to the sort of confusion and the integrity of what these justices assume is their agenda. Is their agenda justice or is their agenda much more political? Now, you mentioned that it might be a 4-3. So the person that recused himself last time, why was there a recusal and why did that person not recuse this time?
So the plaintiffs who are challenging this near total abortion ban are Planned Parenthood of the Heartland, which is the main Planned Parenthood affiliate in Iowa, and then something called the Emma Goldman Clinic, which is an independent abortion provider in Iowa City. And a Cedar Rapids law firm represents the Emma Goldman Clinic. And Justice Dana Oxley, prior to being appointed to the Iowa Supreme Court, was a partner at that Cedar Rapids law firm. So although she didn't directly work on the case, when the previous litigation began, which was in 2018, right after the legislature tried to adopt that law, she was a partner at that law firm. She was then appointed to the Iowa Supreme Court in 2020. And so that litigation was something that happened while she was still in private practice. Now, this new case, she's already been on the court now for 4 years. This new case just began last summer after the Iowa Supreme Court, or after the Iowa legislature, rather, in a special session, passed a carbon copy near total abortion ban. And so there was no reason why she would need to recuse. Right. There were some people who thought perhaps she might recuse, but I don't think that she was, to my knowledge, she was never directly involved in representing the Emma Goldman Clinic. So that is why. And that was one reason why during the split decision that happened last summer, when the state was trying to bring back the old abortion ban, one of the justices said, look, why don't we wait and decide a case when we actually have a full court who can hear that? And that's what they have with this case, the full complement of seven justices. So we'll see how it goes.
So your jump ball, the one that is now participating, could you tell anything from the questioning of the plaintiffs and the state as to basically what was going on here? What's the headset?
She asked a lot of interesting questions of both sides, so I really didn't get a good sense. I mean, I sense that she's open to the arguments from both sides. I mean, at this stage, the Planned Parenthood and the Emma Goldman Clinic, they're asking the court to leave this law blocked, send it back to lower court so that they can fully develop the record of their arguments, their constitutional arguments on the merits. And she definitely seemed potentially interested in that. I should also say that in the 2022 Iowa Supreme Court decision, which overturned our own state's abortion rights precedent, she did sign on to a plurality opinion that said undue burden should be the standard for now for evaluating abortion regulations, rather than two of her colleagues who signed an opinion that said that we should just adopt rational basis right now. But she didn't. She also was asking some questions. You know, if we say that we should use a rational basis standard, then do you what then do you think we should do? So, I mean, I felt that she was open. She was definitely engaged in the arguments, and she asked several questions of both sides' attorneys, and the attorneys were really relentlessly on message during the oral argument. So there was no moment where anybody just had a catastrophic failure to deal with one of the justices' questions. They were pretty well prepared.
Okay, good. You mentioned that the governor appoints the Supreme Court justices. What kind of like oversight is there over the appointment? Does it have to be approved by the Senate? Or is it just basically whatever Governor Reynolds wants to do, Governor Reynolds gets to do?
No, there are a lot of constraints. So we have a system, I think some people call it the Missouri system. It's a merit-based selection that we adopted in the early 1960s, where there's an independent judicial nominating commission where nine of its members are appointed by the governor and eight members are elected by attorneys around the state. And they, when there are vacancies on the Iowa Court of Appeals or the Iowa Supreme Court, they interview the candidates, the independent commission, they recommend three finalists to the governor, and then the governor has to appoint one of those people. So, but it's not subject to Iowa Senate confirmation. So she can't just choose any crony she wants. She can only choose among the short list that is sent to her by the commission. But then the flip side is that her selections don't have to go through any kind of confirmation process. But generally,
and it's 9-8, and she gets to appoint nine, and lawyers get to appoint eight. So yeah, I just want people to remember 9-8, that still means that she has the majority.
Yeah, it used to be more balanced. It used to be eight governor appointees, eight elected attorneys, and one Iowa Supreme Court justice used to serve as chair of the commission. And our Republican trifecta changed the law in 2019 to allow the governor to put his thumb on the scales a little bit more by having that ninth appointment. But I should say that generally speaking, our judicial nominating commissions, I mean, they do forward qualified candidates to our governor. So it's not, as I mentioned,
not like the Federalist Society, what Leonard Leo picks. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I always get nervous. It's like, oh God, what are they picking? You know, are they like 27 years old, have never been in a courtroom, and basically are an ideologue? But what you're telling me is because of the... Nature. It's good.
You just don't know. I mean, our Chief Justice was the governor's first appointee to the Iowa Supreme Court in 2018. And I just assumed that she would want to overturn the abortion rights precedent, but she actually dissented from the 2022 case. She would have upheld the abortion rights precedent and said that and struck down the law that was in question in that case. So you really can't predict. And so, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen. And it's also possible that they could leave the injunction in place for now and let the case go through. And then when it comes back to them, they could decide to uphold the abortion ban later. I mean, there are a lot of ways they could handle the case, but it is very possible that before the end of June, which is probably when they'll issue their ruling, it's possible that the state could gain the power to enforce this ban, and things would change in a hurry for Iowans, because we have not, I think many Iowans are still not aware of what this legal context is for abortion here, because although Republicans have tried to pass several abortion bans, they haven't succeeded in enforcing any of them yet.
Isn't it sad that you have to sort of live with the horror before you understand what the horror is, because you're looking at it like surrounding you, whether you're in Texas or whether you're in Florida. It's like, well, I'm going to stay with 20 weeks. Well, for how long? You know, right. And then you see the long arm of states like Texas where they deputize people so that, you know, are you actually protected because you've got the 20 weeks? And you see states like Massachusetts passing laws to protect their doctors, you know, in case that they're, you know, working on a individual from Texas, you know, because of the quote unquote, the immunity issue, you know, what's going to happen if someone sues a Massachusetts doctor, even though it's legal in Massachusetts. You still want to put this sort of mode of protection around your people that are working with people who don't happen to live in Massachusetts, but come there because it may be the only location they can come to actually get a legal abortion. So this is impacting us whether you're in a safe state or not. Please.
No question. And one of the briefs that 16 different groups submitted briefs to the Iowa Supreme Court, urging them to either leave the injunction in place or lift the injunction. But there was a group of doctors, OBGYNs in neighboring states, that issued an amicus brief that said, look, if this ban goes into effect, we don't know that our states can absorb. I mean, we're already under strain.
Exactly. So places Thank you.
That abortion rights are protected, Illinois and Minnesota mainly. They said this would really strain our systems to have to deal with an influx of many, many women from Iowa seeking their basic health care.
Well, that's the story of Florida. I mean, if Florida goes into that sort of 6-week abortion ban, because right now it's like one of the only places in the South where you can actually still get an abortion, I think up until about 15 weeks, the numbers would be like 83,000. Where would they go?
Yeah.
Where would they go? We're not talking about a couple of hundred people. You know, these are both the 83,000, I think, represented people that have come to Florida, as well as Floridians that have accessed abortion. And all of a sudden, if you pull that plug, what happens? How do you absorb those numbers? It's just astronomical. All right, before we let you go, Laura, let's talk about food and kids, because I've been all over this. We recently had a state representative who died at the age of 80, and I went over to see him at hospice. And one of the biggest things that he was working on before he died was that we wanted to expand the free lunch program from 135% of poverty level to 350%. And what you don't know is that what's so interesting is New Hampshire is the seventh richest state in the nation, right? And we're at 135%, which is the lowest you could go. That's because the feds pay for everything up into 135%. It turns out that the seventh richest state, New Hampshire, is surrounded by Vermont, Maine, and Massachusetts. And guess what's true about all those three states? All three of those states provide universal free lunches. Mm-hmm. Universal for every kid.
Now, Minnesota does as well.
Right. And Massachusetts is a wealthy state, but guess what? Vermont and Maine, they ain't. Okay, but they provide universal free lunches. So for us to be at 135% is an embarrassment. But I think what happened in Iowa is in some ways maybe an even bigger embarrassment. So explain to us what you rejected for the summer food program and what Governor Reynolds is trying to sort of float as an alternative to it, which is kind of a joke and an insult.
The USDA has been running a program called Summer EBT for a number of years. It was expanded during the pandemic. So the idea is that when school is not in session, all students who qualify for free or reduced price lunch would get a certain amount of money for this coming summer. It's going to be $40 a month. And it comes to their families or their parent or guardian on a benefit card that they could use anywhere, farmer's market or any kind of grocery store to buy food. So it would be $40 per child per month for the 3 months of the summer that the federal government pays for. The state only has to pay the administrative costs of running this program. So our governor, along with about a dozen other Republican governors in the winter, decided to reject this federal funding. morning. So she rejected Kim Reynolds' $29 million in federal funding that would have fed an estimated 240,000 Iowa kids, would have given their families $40 a month for each month of the summer. And so she said, well, this program, you know, it's not sustainable. And anyway, it doesn't help with nutrition. And we have an epidemic of childhood obesity. And so we're going to expand existing summer meal programs instead. So this was in December when she rejected the money. Last week, her administration announced what they're actually doing. So instead of $29 million from the federal government that could feed 240,000 kids, she has created a $900,000 grant program, competitive grants. It's still federal dollars. It's funded by the American Rescue Plan, and sites, schools, churches, other nonprofits or organizations can sign up to offer free summer meals to people. It's not bad to have organizations offering summer meals to kids, but the problem is a lot of people are not going to have transportation. They might not live near any of those summer meal sites. And so the summer EBT program was reaching every single person because everybody shops for food somewhere and would get one of these cards that they can use. So $900,000, it's about 3% of the funding that she rejected, and it's not going to reach nearly as many kids. So as many of my readers said, this is like the Hunger Games Iowa version. Yes.
Let me remind everyone that it's $40 per child for 3 months. Now, it benefits families. Absolutely. Money is fungible. It means that you're not just feeding little Tutty, you're feeding the whole family. But guess who also benefits from the $29 million? Walmart, with the big food that they sell, every kind of Kroger's. I mean, let's think about all the grocers that would benefit from the $29 million that Governor Reynolds and the Republicans in Iowa rejected. I mean, talk about cutting off your nose to spite your face. And the only cost at all in Iowa would be the cost of administration. Now, I'm kind of curious, with the cost of administration, you know, I mean, what would that cost? I mean, maybe $1 million?
It would have been about $2 million, but that's less than what the governor is spending to send our National Guard troops down to Texas to do the border security that they're doing down there. I mean, she spent millions of dollars on cable TV advertising to try to encourage people to come to Iowa. She spends millions of dollars on lots of other initiatives when she wants to do it. So I really don't think that cost was an impediment. I should say, with the grocery stores, I have been disappointed. Our Republican trifecta gone after food assistance in several different ways. This was the latest action by the governor, but the legislature last year also passed a very strict asset test that's going to probably end up kicking a bunch of people off food assistance. And I was very disappointed that the grocery industry, and these are some pretty powerful lobbyists, they were very quiet about it. And I don't know why.
Now, have you sat down with them and asked them why? I mean, I want to like confront them and say, why would you reject this? This is no skin off your nose. Your people would benefit. You already know that, you know, the retail industry isn't a very incredibly profitable business. And this would basically guarantee that this money would come to you. It's not going to go into a shoe. It's not going to go somewhere else. It's going to come directly to you. And we're talking $29 million, which isn't chump change. I am so shocked that they are not willing to step forward and say, this is good for families, good for our community, and good for our business.
I mean, I have not talked to their lobbyists and to try to find out what's going on. I assume that there are other issues that they want the legislature or the governor to do in Iowa, and they don't want to antagonize them by being outspoken. But historically, the industry of food retailers was part of the alliance that has kept the federal farm bill going. That's why nutrition programs are part of the farm bill, because grocery store chains understand that these policies benefit them.
So I'm going to make a recommendation since you do Bleeding Heartland. So I've got it sitting right next to me. Have you ever seen the Harper's Index?
Oh, yes.
Okay,
sure.
Yes. Okay. I think it's time for you to do the Bleeding Heartland Index. And I'm dead serious, because the beauty of the Harper's Index is that everything is about a number. All right. And sometimes when you lay the numbers out and you name them out in sort of this order, you tell a very powerful story. And I love the Harper's Index because I immediately race to it every time the magazine comes out, because it's usually they have these three or four numbers that are like called together, because as you go from one to the second one to the third one, you are so angry by the time you get to the last one, because the numbers tell the story. And as you've heard me say over and over again, that if I ever ran for office again, my entire campaign would be about do the math. And the story you're telling, for example, about food, is about doing the math. Story that you're telling about abortion, in some ways, is also about do the math. Where will people go? All right, what will they do? This is about your future, your community, your life, your body, and it has financial consequences as well. So I don't know you have extra time, I'm sure you don't, but I think it's time for the Heartland, the Bleeding Heartland, to start doing, you know, your index, because there are so many numbers coming out of Iowa that are so powerful that if people just looked at them, they would know that you're not doing a political agenda. You are giving them the math so they can make up their own mind. And the math is withering. And on that note, if it's once a month, it must be Laura Belin. Laura Belin is the publisher, editor, and primary reporter for the Bleeding Heartland, a community website focused on Iowa politics. If you want an Iowa political nerd, it's her. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for doing this, Laura.
Oh, thanks for having me again, Arnie.
It's a pleasure. This, everyone, is a Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will schmooze tomorrow, everyone. Ciao. You bet. Just